This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are closely engaged with countries in the region, leaders in the region, and certainly horrified by what we've seen as ongoing human rights abuses in Ethiopia.
That was Jane Psaki, White House Press Secretary, on reports that Ethiopian and Eritrean forces have been systematically raping and abusing hundreds of women and girls in the country's northern Tigray region. Details coming up. Also, Nigeria's information minister says his government will soon lift the ban on Twitter. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story today is in Zambia, where voting began this morning in the presidential and legislative elections. Thousands of people lined up before dawn to cast their ballots. President Edgar Lungu is counting on his record of infrastructure developments and the distribution of agricultural inputs such as seeds to give him another term in office. His main rival is Hakainde Hichilema, who says his background as a businessman will help the country attract investment and revive the struggling economy. There are 14 other presidential candidates. If none gathers more than 50% of the vote, there will be a runoff. The results are expected to be announced by Sunday. VOA's Peter Cloete is in Lusaka, and he spoke with editor Kate Pound-Dawson a short time ago.
Kate, you will not believe it. There is a massive turnout across Lusaka. It is unbelievable, the turnout. The suggesting that the deployment of the military would dampen down people's enthusiasm to vote could be thrown through the window. I mean, the number of people, the lines were so long. People told me that they slept at the polling station so they would be among the first people to vote. And it's unbelievable. I spoke with the one of the presiding officers of the Electoral Commission at the polling station, and she was telling me that everything went smoothly, but people told her that they came in at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m. I spoke with two of the voters who were in line to vote, and one told me she got in at 4:30 a.m. The other told me he got in at 4:45 a.m. So,
what is the mood like there in Lusaka?
The mood is somber. It's quiet. There is no jubilation. People are not necessarily jumping up and about. But one thing I can tell you, at one of the polling stations, there's this gospel group, about five guys and one playing the guitar and singing gospel songs and lightening the mood in one of the polling stations I visited early this morning. And it's been smooth so far. I spoke with some poll observers, including the African Union poll observers who were at the grounds, and they told me that it was peaceful. I also happened to interact with the former president of Tanzania, who is the lead observer for the Commonwealth of Nations poll observer mission here. And he also told me briefly that for what they have witnessed so far, it's been peaceful and the process has been smooth. The chairperson or the African Union head, poll observer head, told me that he specifically asked the polling agent at the polling stations whether there is any problem, whether they have any issues with how the process is moving, and they all answered, quote, in a resounding yes, they are satisfied with how the process has been ongoing since morning.
When do we expect results? And what do we know about if a runoff election is needed, when that would be held?
Well, usually within 60 days when none of the 16 presidential candidates as we have now is able to garner the 50% plus one vote threshold needed to be declared winner of the presidential election. For the result or the outcome of the election, the Electoral Commission officials are telling me they will announce the results hopefully within 3 days of voting. So by Sunday, hopefully, we should know the next president. That is what they tell me. Some people are very optimistic and saying that perhaps late Saturday night to early Sunday morning, people in Zambia will know whether they have extended the mandate of incumbent President Edgar Chagwalungu or giving rejected him or giving Hakainde Hichilema, the main opposition leader, the nod to become the next president.
That was Peter Cloete, host of VOA's Nightline Africa program, speaking to Kate Pound-Dawson. President Kais Saied launched his takeover of executive powers in Tunisia by relying on the armed forces, an institution never before involved in politics. But since his announcement, an armored vehicle has prevented access to the parliament building and military units have been deployed at the seat of government and other key institutions. Professor Khalid Chouket, former Tunisian Minister of Parliamentary Affairs, discussed the neutrality of the Tunisian army with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The Tunisian army has not had any traditions since its founding in 1958 to interfere in political affairs. And it is disciplined army to the constitution. And this is a rare thing in this region, in the Arab world, the Middle East, and Africa. The President Saied involved the army in matters that did not concern it. The normal places for the army is barracks and not the interference in the political system or affairs. I hope Saied will refrain from giving orders to army with political goals.
The foreign ministers of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and recently Bahrain individually met with the Tunisian president to relay their country's leaders' backing of his moves that were perceived as a coup. What are these countries seeking to do in Tunisia?
That's true. I think that the support of countries such as Egypt, Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain for Saied's decisions is due to two main reasons. The first reason, these countries are embarrassed by the existence of a real democratic system in the Arab world, because their people will find support for their demand for a democratic system also. This is the first reason. The second reason, these countries or systems have regimes opposing the participation of Islamic movements, especially specifically the Muslim Brotherhood movements. And the case of Tunisia, which is based on integration of Islamists in the political system or in the political life, make a problem for them, for these countries. I think Tunisians will defend peacefully the coexistence between secularists and Islamists.
So would these countries succeed in excluding political Islam from the Tunisian political scene?
They see Nahda party as a big enemy. And they see our system, which is based on this coexistence between secular people and Islamic movements, a big problem for them.
That was Professor Khalid Chouket, former Tunisian Minister of Parliamentary Affairs, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. Nigeria's information minister says his government will soon lift its ban on Twitter. And South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, says he chose to keep quiet in public about government corruption when he was deputy president. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says he chose to keep quiet in public about government corruption when he was deputy president between 2014 and 2018. Ramaphosa was testifying at an inquiry into graft that's become known as state capture in South Africa. Former President Jacob Zuma appointed friends and political allies to head state enterprises, and they allegedly looted the companies of billions of dollars. Darren Taylor reports.
Journalists began reporting on the alleged rot within the Zuma administration soon after he became president in 2008. But state capture apparently reached its zenith while Ramaphosa was Zuma's deputy for more than 4 years. Ramaphosa says he became aware that Zuma was allegedly dirty as far back as 2015. That's when the then president briefly appointed a minor member of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, as finance minister. Ramaphosa testified he played a key role in forcing Zuma to reverse the appointment. Ramaphosa says after this near fiasco, he considered resigning as deputy president, but chose not to.
Had I and like-minded individuals resigned from the executive, we would have had no ability to resist some of the excesses that were taking place. And there was a clear danger that without some measure of resistance, there would have been even fewer impediments to the unfettered expansion of the state capture project.
Ramaphosa says he was only sure state capture was really happening in 2017 when the media published a series of emails. Those appear to show collusion between Zuma, other senior members and supporters of the ANC, and two Indian businessmen brothers, Atul and AJ Gupta, to plunder government corporations. Ramaphosa says he then decided to oppose Zuma for the ANC leadership. In late 2017, Ramaphosa defeated Zuma and was elected president of the country a few months later. Like many South Africans, Professor William Gumede isn't convinced by Ramaphosa's testimony.
The president, like many other ANC members, sat there quietly, you know, for a decade, saying nothing, didn't speak out. Where's the moral courage? Saying that one is working from inside to change things, really that is just essentially indirectly supporting corruption and abetting corruption. And that is one of the reasons why, you know, corruption has become so systemic and for such a long time, because many people, like the president in the ANC, sat there quietly working from inside.
The chairman of the Democracy Works Foundation says Ramaphosa's contention that he didn't know how bad the graft was until 2017 is an insult to citizens.
There's been journalistic reports, there's been whistleblowers. It seems like everyone in the country knew about corruption except the ANC leadership.
He says if Ramaphosa really wanted to combat ANC corruption, he would have walked away from the deputy presidency and his party membership.
I think if he had resigned, if he had spoken out and he was ejected from the party, he was fired, it would actually have stopped corruption right there and there, because he then would have been out in the public. He could have formed his own political party, take some of the ANC members who are honest and conscious with him.
Gumede believes that Ramaphosa's continued presence as a top member of the Zuma administration actually encouraged ANC corruption. The analyst says despite a couple of arrests of ANC officials for alleged corruption, Ramaphosa's nowhere close to fulfilling his promise of a clean government.
I don't think he even sees the power that he has. He is now the president of the country. I mean, no one has more political power than him. But I mean, he still acts as if he doesn't have the power. He still acts as if he is the deputy president with no power. Maybe that's a real disappointment for many of his supporters.
Ramaphosa, however, points to a list of actions he's taken to right the ship of state in the past few years, including his appointment of credible legal teams to prosecute Zuma, among others. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A new report by human rights group Amnesty International says Ethiopian government forces and Eritrean forces have been systematically raping and abusing hundreds of women and girls in the conflict in the country's northern Tigray region. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Women and children are bearing the brunt of the suffering in the ongoing fighting in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region. As part of a new report, Amnesty International spoke to 63 survivors of rape and sexual violence from Tigray, in addition to health professionals working with the survivors. Among these survivors, 38 of them said the rapes were perpetrated by Eritrean soldiers. Fiseha Tekla is an Amnesty International researcher for the Horn of Africa.
Victims were detained for more than 24 hours and in some cases for weeks while they were being raped by the soldiers. And in the process, we can see that the soldiers were brutalizing the survivors. They were beating them. They were using demeaning words or ethnic slurs against the victims, which shows that sexual violence was used to dehumanize the Tigrayan women in the ongoing conflict.
A 20-year-old woman told Amnesty she was attacked in her home in November 2020 by armed men who spoke Amharic. She was 4 months pregnant. She told Amnesty, "I don't know if they realized I was pregnant. I don't know if they realized I was a person." Amnesty's Adote Akwe told VOA the report is a small snapshot of what is happening on the ground.
The ages of the women, as young as 10 and as old as 62. The use of racial slurs to basically identify them as Tigrayan women. And also the deliberate multiple incidents of rape by many men, even when the women were pregnant.
Akwe told VOA at the time of publication of the report, the Ethiopian government had not issued a response. But there was a tweet in response from neighboring country Eritrea's Minister of Information, Yemani Meskel. The AI report is transparently unprofessional, and it is evident that the AI makes no effort to get the facts right and cross-check the veracity of the allegations. Asked about the report by VOA, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki had this response.
We are closely engaged with countries in the region, leaders in the region, and certainly horrified by what we've seen as ongoing human rights abuses in Ethiopia.
The State Department has repeatedly called on all parties to the conflict to stop fighting and allow humanitarian and medical relief to get through to millions in Ethiopia who are suffering and facing famine. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali is urging civilians to join the country's armed forces as the fighting escalates with Tigray People's Liberation Front fighters. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Nigeria's information minister, Lai Mohammed, has told reporters in Abuja that his government will soon lift its ban on Twitter after resolving some of its differences with the social media platform. The government suspended Twitter on June 4th after it removed a post from President Muhammadu Buhari that threatened to punish regional secessionists. Nigerian officials defend the suspension, saying Twitter was used to promote destabilizing activities. The ban on Twitter drew condemnation from Nigerian civil society groups, including some that sued the government over it, and also the U.S. government. Nearly 3 months after the visit of French President Emmanuel Macron, who promised a new chapter in relations in Rwanda, results are starting to unfold. The first French ambassador in 6 years has arrived. As Eugene Uimana reports from Kigali, the new ambassador says he has been given a mission to mend relations by addressing mainly judicial issues.
It's been 6 years since France had an ambassador in Rwanda. Recently, Antoine Humphrey presented his letters of credentials to Rwandan President Paul Kagame. At a news conference this week, the new ambassador said his mission includes working together to bring genocide suspects in France to justice. Humphrey says there is a case of a genocide suspect going to court in October or November. He also says France will have a department dedicated to fighting crimes against humanity that is comprised of police and gendarmes to support the prosecution. On the 20th September, an officer will be stationed at the embassy in charge of linking departments of prosecution both in Paris and Kigali. The issue of justice is important in Rwanda-France relations. Over the past two decades, the Rwandan government has accused France of being an accomplice in the genocide perpetrated against the Tutsis in 1994. Paris has been accused of letting genocide suspects roam freely. This is the French President Emmanuel Macron at a news conference during his visit to Rwanda in May this year. Macron says his first priority is to do everything possible to boost judicial cooperation. He goes on to say the second priority is to put the necessary infrastructure in place to ensure that suspects face the law. Among other priorities, the new French ambassador told journalists he wants to help attract French investors to Rwanda.
We can organize visits, meetings. We can tell them, well, here in Rwanda, you have the right framework for investment. You have a reliable partner. You have a good investment code. You have a law which is stable, with a taxation system also which is stable and so on. And then, the French companies will come.
Rwanda's President Paul Kagame has welcomed the French report that said France had overwhelming responsibility for the 1994 genocide, in which more than 800,000 people, mostly ethnic Tutsis, died. He also praised Macron's speech at the Kigali Genocide Memorial, in which the French president said his government had ignored warning signs and failed to act to prevent the genocide. The French report and Macron, in his speech, however, said that France was not complicit in the killings. Eugene Uwimana, VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
A leading Ivory Coast political figure sentenced to a 20-year jail term in absentia has been arrested by security forces in Bali. The French news agency AFP reports that Mohamed Sassi Soukou, also known as Ben Souk, was arrested Tuesday in Mali's capital, Bamako. He served as a leader of the Generation and Peoples in Solidarity GPS party, founded by former Ivory Coast Prime Minister Julian Soro, who was once a close ally of Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara, but fell out of favor with him in early 2019 and went into exile. Now that Ben Souk has been arrested in Mali, his supporters say they will fight back by hiring a lawyer. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, Thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.